Okay, I'd like to welcome everyone to this second concurrent session. The topic today is the three reviews, Henry, Cooper and Ripoll. And speaking, we've got Jennifer Lang and Lee Cobus. So as a brief introduction, Jennifer is Chief Actuary of Wealth Management at Commonwealth Bank. She has 20 years' experience in the financial services industry, including working for life insurance companies, an asset manager and a financial services consultant, and obviously is now at the Commonwealth Bank. Jennifer's written a number of papers over the years, including the choice of risk discount rates for the valuation of life insurance companies and on asset liability modelling for life and general insurers. Lee Cobus is the current portfolio actuary of investment products at the Commonwealth Bank. Lee also has more than 20 years' experience in life insurance and superannuation, in the valuation of defined benefit superannuation, individual life and group insurance, and has spent a number of years in product development and distribution. Nearly 8 of those years have been spent in Australia, while the rest of it in South Africa. We don't hold that against him. Lee's a fellow of the Faculty of Actuaries in Scotland and has received his Fellow of the Institute of Australia this year. So if you'd like to welcome the speakers to the podium, obviously we'll have time for questions at the end. Thank you.
Thanks, Wade. So welcome to this session. I'll just check the way I put this forward. Yep. So the agenda for this is talking through, as Wade has talked about, the three inquiries. The title of this session is the three inquiries. But the motivation for this session for us is that there are these three inquiries going on at the moment. The major commentary that is happening on those inquiries has really been from a funds management perspective. So we've got Ripoll, Cooper and Henry, all of which have major impacts on the financial services sector. But even within our part of the financial services sector, if you read most commentary, the major direct impacts has been around funds management. We thought it was quite important, particularly for an audience at this forum, to have a look at the impact on life insurers, because there are going to be some direct and indirect impacts from life insurers. So what we've done is go through and had a look at those impacts, many of which are the same as the fund managers, but many of which are different and come from flow-on effects. So first of all, a little bit of a background about what are these three inquiries and where are they up to. I've got a timeline slide later on, but the key point here is that there's a lot going on right now. So we've made every attempt to get this presentation up to date. We had to beg, borrow and steal a bit of time from the Institute to go past the deadlines, but here we are. But very much interested in the conversation that will result after our presentation on other views about what's happening from these three inquiries. So the Ripoll inquiry, first of all, set up after the various company collapses that happened during the GFC, Storm and Oprah's Prime, etc., to look at the role played by financial advisors, their remuneration, potential conflicts of interests, and the way in which financial services products are sold to retail investors. And you probably will have seen that the government responded to all of those recommendations on April the 26th. So we've had a look at that response as well as the recommendations. Second review, the Cooper review, still very much ongoing. The aim of that is to look at how to achieve better governance, efficiency and operation of the superannuation system as a whole, including the structure of the whole system within Australia. That's released a number of preliminary documents in the last month or so, but has not yet had a government response. And finally, the Henry Review, which is mammoth and not just the financial services sector but the whole economy, looking at the review of Australia's tax and transfer system to look at how Australia should be positioned for demographic, social, economic and environmental challenges of the 21st century. So an enormous brief there, and life insurance is very much a tiny part of that. And as you will have seen, the report and the government response was released on May the 2nd, and the government did promise that they wouldn't do anything last weekend, and they didn't, but they did just have a budget. So there are also potentially some impacts on life insurance from that, which we haven't specifically looked at in this presentation. So a quick look at the timeline, just to give you a sense of what's been going on. So we've got the Cooper, the Ripoll, and the Henry Review, various reports released to the government and to the public along that timeline. You can see from where we are at the moment, there's still a little bit more to come, basically around the Cooper Review, but largely the other reports have been released. We've also just put a comment there about product rationalisation, not the subject of this presentation, but also very relevant to life insurers, and that's consultation that's going on at the moment. So I guess the key point that I want to make here is that Lee and I both work for the Commonwealth Bank. This presentation is very much a personal view of what we think is going to happen to the industry. It's not the Commonwealth Bank view. I'm sure there's probably many different views within the people who work for the Commonwealth Bank, but this is very much our own view of what might happen and what life insurers' strategic imperatives might be. So turning now to the Ripol inquiry, the structure we've got for this presentation is I'm going to be talking through the Ripol inquiry. Lee's going to be talking through Cooper. I'll come back and have a quick overview of Henry, which is a less of a big issue for life insurers, and just bring the whole lot together. We're hoping to do that in probably 25 minutes to half an hour, and then we very much appreciate comments as well as questions from the floor, because given how much is going on at the moment, we don't pretend to have all the answers as to what the implications of these various legislative changes might be. So Ripol, there's two key recommendations that we've drawn out here for have a major impact for life insurers. First one is this one about fiduciary duty. Recommended that the Corporations Act include fiduciary duty, requiring advisers to place clients' interests ahead of their own. So the government response to that report supported that recommendation, so it seems fairly likely to happen. But there's quite a number of interesting implications from that for life insurers in particular. I guess requiring fiduciary duty does require an advisor to do a lot of work understanding clients' needs. What they're effectively doing already, but it provides a greater onus to make sure that they're doing everything they possibly can. So the implications really for the financial advisors would be increased training and compliance costs, so potentially an increased cost of advice to make sure that the advisors are equipped to do that, to perform that fiduciary duty. And I guess the other very specific to life insurers possibility is increasing again the dependence on rating houses. So particularly those advisors who are covering both the savings and insurance sectors, having to know everything that there is to know about all potential products out there, rating houses perform a very useful function for advisors there. So particularly things like trauma definitions, the way in which particular products are structured, that you would expect to have greater reliance on rating houses from some advisors. So the aim of this is to develop financial planning professionalism, a more respected profession, and I guess that we'll see how that plays out. The second major recommendation from the Ripol inquiry, the government to support industry to cease payments for product manufacturers to financial advisors for retail investment products, recommendation four. This is probably the bigger impact, and what the government actually did was respond with interest effectively. So very much that what they're looking for is the financial advisors to be agents of the client rather than agents of the company. So the specific government response there, I've actually put the press release paragraph in full there because I think it's quite important to see what they've said. It's not just about commission, it's about all conflicted remuneration structures, including commissions, volume-based payment in relation to distribution of advice of retail investment products, including managed investment, superannuation and margin loans. The measure does not initially apply to risk insurance. So a few questions that occurred to us out of that. So what is risk insurance? There is no definition in the documentation so far that I've seen. What happens with, is there a scope to have a savings proportion of a product that might have to be separated out? Will people be trying to go back to the old whole of life days to be able to pay commissions again? Another key question, more for the fund managers than for the insurers at this stage, is what does prospective mean? Does it include top-ups on existing contracts? Does it include current contracts that have already been written, future commission paid on past contracts? Or is it just new contracts only? And then I guess the final question, particularly relevant for life insurers, what does not initially imply mean? Does that mean it's not for the first 6 months or not for some time because there's no expectation, because the government really hasn't decided exactly what to do in that space? So we've looked at some possible implications of ceasing conflicted remuneration structures on life insurers. So just to reiterate, there's no direct ceasing of commission for life insurance, but we see that given how much those two industries are intertwined and the distribution is intertwined, there are going to be implications. So you would expect distributors, obviously, to move to fee-for-service for investment business. Will that mean that they will also move to fee-for-service for risk business to make their business model simpler? So would they be then effectively expecting the product manufacturers to enable a fee-for-service type of product rather than the embedded commission that most advice products have today? You would probably expect a greater variety of advice business models depending on what kind of products are sold by the various advisors. And potentially there could be competition on price for people who are advising on fee-for-service. That's not something you particularly see today, but if everyone is having to... If financial advisors are having a very clear headline fee, they're potentially going to start competing on price. I guess the other advisor-driven potential outcome could be that risk business becomes enormously popular because advisors are very keen to sell it because they can still get a commission on it. Will we have some movement towards polarisation? The UK model's been mentioned a few times in conversations I've had. So you're either an in-house advisor employed by the company and not really an advisor but a salesperson, or you're completely independent, so less middle ground. And is there more of an alignment between advisors and investor interests? I think the interesting thing for this perspective from a life insurer's perspective is the life insurer is, nothing is directly changing for the life insurer, but the distribution economics for advice business and the funds management is changing, so can potentially change quite a lot, which will have implications, I expect, for a number of advice-based sales within the life risk business. So talked here about the major implications. I've really covered most of them because I think most of the major implications are from the commission move, but I think there is this interrelationship with the fiduciary duty, that because advisors are being required to very, very much ramp up their fiduciary duty to clients, we've also got the need for them to consider very widely all the possibilities. So would there be more take-up for advice at the lower end of the market from the commission side? But there are also potentially increased costs from training and compliance obligations, which will make it harder to get into the advice business. And I guess the two potential moves towards a fee-for-service arrangement for life insurance from people who mostly sell funds management product, or potentially in the opposite direction from people who start selling a lot more risk business because that is the way that they can earn commissions. So, I'd love to be able to say this is what I think the market's going to happen. I think it's too early to tell, but I think there's a lot of different drivers pushing things in different directions. So there will be net impacts on quality and cost of advice in a number of different directions, and here we've just put together a few of them. So then I'll hand over to Lee to talk about Cooper.
So just to remind you, Cooper is the full name is the Review into Governance, Efficiency, Structure and Operation of Australia's Superannuation System. So to cover that scope, the review's been divided into three phases. There's been a number of papers published last year, issues papers to bring the issues out for discussion. And since that time, in the last couple of months, we've had three interim reports. The final report is only due just over a month from now, so everything is still in the proposal stage, and pretty much what we've got here is quite speculative. So just to start off with looking at the structure, which is a good place to start, Cooper's proposing what's called the choice architecture model, where the super system is divided into four different categories representing increasing member choice. So if you start at the left there, the first category is disconnected, which is the equivalent of today's IRF products, which is really for disengaged members. The next category, called universal there, probably I think that's morphed into My Super in more recent reports. This category is really driven by trustee decision, and so we've got simple cost-efficient super delivering single investment strategies and basic insurance cover, basically at the trustee's discretion. The next category choice is the one with the full supermarket of investment options, and also member choice with regard to insurance cover. And finally, the self-managed category is the equivalent of today's self-managed super funds. So if we look at that structure, it's pretty much an evolution of what we've got today, or the products we've got today. You can see morphing into that architecture, but there's more of a focus on the needs of members and their requirements. So it's probably more an incremental than a revolutionary type model. What we foresee is after probably an initial period of disruption where we have a need to meet new licensing requirements for each of those different categories, there's probably an increased burden of compliance on life insurers offering those products, and probably some degree of complexity to manage in product managing them as well. But as I said, in many respects, we could probably see that it's more a natural extension of what we've already got. So looking at some of the more specific aspects, an interesting idea was raised in the initial issues papers of a single government-sponsored IRF. So that probably seems less likely, not the direction that things are headed, given what's been written put out in the interim reports. But it still remains interesting for us because there was quite a lot of criticism levelled at IRFs in those initial issues papers. So IRFs were described as being the highest cost superannuation sector, which is not good. They were criticised for not meeting one of their primary objectives, which is to match members to their lost super, and also for passing on member protection costs and thereby eroding investment returns to members. So throughout the review, there's a focus on achieving efficiency in delivering super, and this generally is thought to be best achieved by reducing costs through achieving scale. So it implies some sort of consolidation, perhaps, and also through a review of what profit margins are, which carries the sort of implication that many super products have got high profit margins built in, and that needs to be reviewed. So the two interesting aspects that came out in the preliminary reports were around the licensing requirements for IRFs in future will include a requirement for IRFs to pursue active cross-matching programs to match their members to Lost Super, and also online facilities so that the public can do that themselves. So that's something new. And the other one is that the current member protection rules will probably be removed, and that will probably lead to decreased flows to IRFs as there's less incentive for super funds to pass on their membership. So in the default fund category called My Super now, again, the focus on efficiencies, an acknowledgement that economies of scale deliver investment synergies, so improved returns from that. But the focus is more, again, on reducing costs. And, again, this implies some degree of consolidation in this sector. And profit margins are mentioned once again. Now, as existing funds strive to meet these licensing requirements, we expect we may see some change in the balance of power between current funds where ratings are changing, maybe people dropping off default listings. So there's going to be some sort of shift going on there, and with that also probably a shift in the wholesale risk business that goes with it. So an interesting aspect of the MySuper proposals is that minimum levels of death cover will be required to be provided. However, trustees will also have the obviously have the option to increase those levels of cover that are offered to members. In addition, offer TPD and income protection. So the other aspect is that members will have the ability to opt. They have to be given the ability to opt out of that cover, but they, with this all these flexible covers, they'll also have the option to opt into higher cover. So that raises possible issues around anti-selection, with depending on the degree of flexibility that actually comes out of all of that. But we foresee that we're thinking that insurance coverage is certainly going to be increasing, and that means higher premium flows for life insurers and possibly increased competition for those flows. But that's possibly going to be offset by a concept which Cooper discusses around having sufficient risk pools to self-insure. So it's suggested that probably as a result of this consolidation, there's more funds with ability to carry their own insurance arrangements and thereby deliver better value to the membership. So that remains to be seen whether that happens, and invite your views on that. So there's some of the implications that I've gone through today, and look forward to your comments on some of those. And I hand back to Jennifer now to wrap us up. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Lee. And clearly there's lots of interesting things that could happen to life insurance in Cooper. The Henry Review, just a reminder, the Henry Review is the review of the whole tax and transfer system. So life insurance implications in there are probably quite minor. What we've done here is just put in the main recommendations that came from Henry. But noting that the government's initial response has very much to... They've taken up a few recommendations, they've ruled out a few recommendations, but there's a large number of recommendations that are still yet to be responded to in either direction. So the first one that they've recommended is government annuitisation. That's one of the few that they've actually ruled out. This proposal was that the government provides immediate annuities and deferred annuity products rather than it being either in competition with or instead of private sector. So I'll just move on from there, but put it there. Oh, sorry. Happened there. The next recommendation was around helping the longevity insurance market, that the government should support development by issuance of long-term securities to help insurers or other longevity providers to match their liabilities. That one hasn't been responded to. There's quite a lot about superannuation in the government response, so I'll just quickly mention that the Henry point was that superannuation should probably have some of its tax advantages slightly reduced in a general point. And so they've given a number of different ways in which that can happen to make the playing field somewhat more level with savings. But as we'll see in a moment, the government's probably not really taken that up. And the final point that's relevant to insurers is that Henry did recommend abolition of state taxes and levies on insurance, for example, stamp duty, which is more of a nuisance than a particularly major financial impact on insurers, in that each state has their own different way in which that's levied, so it adds to substantial operational complexity for insurers. So the response that's relevant here from the government to Henry, they've expressly ruled out the government annuities I mentioned, but they haven't ruled out annuitisation as a concept generally. They haven't looked at longevity market yet. As you also have seen, they've announced a phased increase in the superannuation guarantee levy to 12% and increased the maximum age from 70 to 75, and then also put in a few bits and pieces to increase the attractiveness of superannuation to both low-income earners and over 50s where there's they still don't have high superannuation balances. So for the time being, what the government's response has been is to effectively say that superannuation is still a very much their preferred saving method for retirement. I guess the life insurance implications from Henry so far are relatively light. In terms of the government's response, in terms of life insurance markets, the major impact that we saw from the recommendations were looking at the longevity market. Clearly, there was some views in the Henry report that something should be done to improve the accessibility of longevity insurance for Australians post-retirement. The current structure of the tax and transfer system really doesn't encourage it. They've also recommended more value to the government for the tax concessions that they get from super, and some of the suggestions that they've actually taken up probably respond to that in terms of looking at the lower income areas. There is some some sense that other investment products, including insurance bonds, might benefit from an increased focus on savings. Insurance bonds are fairly much a niche product, but one of the few unique products to life insurers. And I guess the other final question is, are there macroeconomic implications from the change in the balance of investments? So at this stage, we don't see Henry or the government's response in really changing the life insurance landscape all that much, except insofar as the greater savings that are coming from the extra guarantee levy may make it more palatable for trustees to increase the insurance in a superannuation fund, so that people are more willing to take out insurance in a super fund because they've got more money available to do it. So to wrap this all up, what we've tried to do is pull out what we think is some potential strategic imperatives for life insurers, very much early days, as I said before. So clearly one strong view is that it's imperative for life insurers to take the initiative with customers to try and make sure that the customers have accessible quality information and advice. There's clearly going to be changes to the way remuneration structures for advice play out, and potentially also some flow-on effects to how non-advice products might be sold. There is potential from Cooper to lead to anti-selection issues depending on how trustees respond to opt-out possibilities in the MySuper, and potential changes in the way that selection happens in the choice area, so that the more choice you're providing to members in terms of their insurance offering, the greater the potential for anti-selection at some point. It doesn't appear to be that point in the current recommendations from Cooper, but it's something worth looking at. At some point, there will be anti-selection issues that could arise out of that. There will clearly be some greater compliance costs, either in the short term to basically respond to changes in legislation, or potentially also in the longer term for advisors in dealing with the fiduciary duty possibility. And there's clearly a changing balance of power in the superannuation landscape between the different levels of funds, the default funds, the large funds, which don't offer all that much choice, and the choice funds that is being suggested by Cooper. And the real question is how will the government take that up? So I guess our take out from all of the different changes that are happening is that there clearly are some strategic challenges ahead for life insurance, even if there aren't that many direct changes. The indirect changes that are happening in the greater investment and funds management space will logically lead to changes for life insurers. So thanks for that, and I'll hand back to Wade.
Okay, if you please join me in thanking Jennifer and Lee for their presentation. Okay, we now have a few minutes for some questions. We should have some roving microphones. So if you could please state your name and your organisation and your question. If you just put up your hand if you'd like to kick things off. We have one over here. So I'll just take a second for the mic to get over there.
Michael Burt, one of the proposals of the Henry Review was to change the super tax on investments from 15% in the accumulation phase and 0% in the pension phase to an average of 7.5%. Would that cause life insurers a major headache, or some life insurers a major headache?
I guess any tax change causes administrative issues, but obviously that would change the relative attractiveness of annuities negatively, and also deferred annuities. So that would obviously change the difference in the landscape. That's not one that I've actually picked up as a major impact on life insurers, but I think potentially that could if it came out.
The reason for asking the question is those insurers have got an existing bank book of annuities and have matched them with fixed interest investments.
Well,
I guess it would depend how it was implemented. If you've sold an annuity on a current basis, which assumes you're going to earn a tax-free return on those assets going forward, then clearly that would change your financial dynamics considerably. And if you did have a major annuity book, I can see someone who's got one in front of me might want to comment. they would clearly change the dynamics.
I think the answer to the question is that a typical annuity policy document will give you the power to change rates on a change in taxation. So it would be an administrative hassle to go and change all the rates, but the financial impact wouldn't be there.
Here we go. Just while the microphone's getting there, I have a question. You talked at the start about the RIPOL suggesting the fiduciary duty. Obviously, the intention is that would apply to the investment side. I'm just wondering, have anyone put their mind to what fiduciary might mean when it comes to recommending an insurance product, sort of commissions aside?
Well, I guess my view would be that it does increase the onus on the advisor to really think through the widest possible choice for their client, and that's why I suggested the rating houses might have more influence in that context, because they've effectively, you know, as an advisor, you need to make sure that you understand everything you possibly can about what's available out there, and that's one of the functions that the rating houses fulfil.
Hi, Natalie Exall from MLC. With the Ripple Inquiry, there's been a lot of focus on the advisors and moving to a fee-for-advice model and what that will mean for them. There doesn't seem to have been much discussion on how dealer groups are going to operate. I know a lot of them, you know, the way that they function at the moment, they rely a lot on overrides or partnership allowance. Have you got any thoughts, I guess, about the fallout associated with that moving forward?
Well, that's one of the reasons that we put up the words in the press release. It's clearly not just about commissions. It's also about any other kind of volume-related basis. So, clearly on both insurance and funds management side, dealer groups do make some of their money and quite a lot in some cases in that way. And they're going to have to change the way they operate because of that. In terms of the exact strategic implications for them, I guess I'll focus more here on the company rather than the dealer group, but clearly there will be some.
We have a question down there.
Kim Chambers, AIA. It was just in relation to Cooper and the MySuper proposal. It seemed to me an opportunity for there to be a shift in the group insurance market, where the MySuper proposal was about providing a better level of default benefits on the investment side, but also there's the opportunity really for the group market to offer slightly more sophisticated offerings to the general population, if you like, where group insurance is potentially offers greater value for money. And we'd also talked at the plenary session this morning about the general apathy in the population, where although people want choice, they don't really actually want to have to make the choice because it's too complicated. So as long as there's there appears to be a choice, but there's a nice default option that they can go to, that would typically be for many people would be their preferred option. So it seemed to be an opportunity in the group market to offer much more sophisticated offerings to the public, and you know, particularly for industry funds who don't have the high cost commission structures, etc. I just wondered if you'd comment on that.
My comment is, I think you know more about it than I do, but yeah, that certainly sounds like an interesting comment. And I mean, this is all we are. It's a bit of speculation, as I said before, as to exactly how it's going to pan out, but. I think that's certainly a possibility. Yeah.
I think the other key thing there is that the preliminary report at least puts the onus very much on trustees to work out what is the best insurance for their members. So really much it strengthens the trustee role there. So that's actually going to be quite challenging, I imagine, particularly if you're in a Papua golfer environment, to get the low-cost advantages of a wholesale-type environment, which some of which come, not all of which come from the fact that you don't have to worry about underwriting, at the same time as trying to get something that covers the life cycle insurance needs of the vast majority of your members.
On a similar point, Cooper has said that he feels that industry funds should consider, I guess, self-insuring or insuring as a pool. I don't see any reason why they couldn't have done so now. How do you think that any sort of push for that would impact the dynamics, or do you think that it's just not necessary and, you know, it could have happened already?
My understanding is that public offer funds generally haven't self-insured at the moment. I guess one question I'd have, and we did put a comment up there on the slides, what should, if super funds do go down that path, what kind of capital would we expect them to hold for the substantial risk they'd be running, both the pricing risk and the volatility risk, and who would be monitoring that? So I guess from a member's point of view, how are the trustees assuring themselves that there is enough money there for the volatility that'd be associated with the insurance?
I think the other aspect of that was that it seems to be pretty limited. I'm not sure if there is much self-insurance, but certainly the suggestion was with increased insurance pools, as seems to be the way things are heading with consolidation of funds into bigger risk pools, that that would certainly be a possibility for the future. And I didn't mention it, but on the slides, it was in the reports itself. Mentioned that with the right regulation from APRA and with actuarial advice, that's something that could certainly be considered by funds in future.
Do we have any other questions from the floor? Don't be shy. Okay, well, maybe I'll ask one more then. You're in the hot seat, the red seat. I guess just you explored the concept of the initial waiver of commissions for risk business, and you explored what that might mean. I'm not sure. Did you put your mind to the, you know, if the opposite of, you know, say in a year's time or 5 years' time, that ban does come in, what some of the implications of that might be for the industry?
That's very much who you talk to. I've asked a few people what they think about this, and I think there are a lot of people who think that there would be a lot less life insurance sold. I'm not. It really depends on your view about how much of life insurance is sold and not bought, and a question of how much all of the different changes that are happening will lead to people just generally understanding their insurance needs better. A good financial plan, which you'd hope that the strong fiduciary requirement would necessitate, would mean that it's incumbent on the financial planner to make sure that people understand that they do need life insurance, whether there is commission for it or not. So I'd like to think that we'd end up in a similar place, but that you'd end up with a smaller share of the total insurance premium going to the advisor and a greater share going in claims. But I think there's a lot of people who would form a different view that would be less sold.
Rhonda Virtue, what impact can you see Cooper, my super, having on the corporate superannuation arrangements, of which there are many within Master Trust and multi-employer funds?
I guess I've largely looked at it from the insurance company's perspective, so I haven't really thought through the corporate side. I guess to the extent that people, that corporates tend to use Master Trust, they tend to already be invested in a combination arrangement which involves insurance. And I think what my super would do is require the trustees of those master funds to enable a much simpler option for corporates. I guess the question would be, what would the corporate do with that? Would they generally just go to down to my super part of a master trust, or would they also offer choice to their members? I'm not sure. I'm not interested in views from people who've thought about it from the corporate side.
Yeah, and I think it's also not clear yet, you know, what the transitional arrangements may be. So funds that are already set up under existing structures, how would that be transitioned into a new structure, and what would be required of them, and exactly where would they fit in that new structure? So I don't think any of that's yet clear. So hopefully with the report being released in a couple of weeks' time, we might get some clarity on some of these things.
Just want to go back two questions or so, and it strikes me that one of the strategic imperatives of organisations, taking into account both Ripol and Cooper in particular, is the need for them to actually change the community's perception in terms of the value of advice. That seems to be at the heart of all these changes, that advice at the present time has not been given, or if it's been given, it's been given poorly, and it hasn't been valued. But I'm interested to know your views about how that will happen in terms of how we will get the community to accept that there is a value in advice.
I think one of the things that we suggested might happen is that the cost of advice might be price competed down, as that was the only charging structure that people... It became much more visible, which potentially, because that's what you're paying for, potentially might mean that people do value it more because they know what they're paying for. I'm not sure about that, because the clear, you know, one of the reasons people historically say life insurance is sold is not bought, is that there is a huge value in somebody advising you that you do need life insurance. It's not something like people like to think about, but how do you get people to value that, forcing them to think about something they don't want to think about? I'm not sure.
Tony Boffinger from Challenger. Would the introduction of a fiduciary duty reduce the attractiveness of owning distribution companies and therefore lead to large companies divesting themselves of them? Because they make no money.
I think that comes back to your view about this, you know, do we go down the polarisation route here? Clearly companies think that there is a value in accessibility of customers via the advisors, depending on how people respond to that fiduciary duty. Does that mean that there's no extra advantage you get from owning an advisor? Potentially, yes. Or potentially the distribution company needs to pay a return more than they do at the moment.
My understanding, in the UK, they're a little way ahead of us in terms of moving to independent distribution, and it's created an interesting effect over there whereby the push for independent distribution has actually resulted in a greater market share of distribution by banks and conglomerates. So a push by the FSA for more independence, some would argue, has resulted in less independence.
That's the polarisation that a lot of people talked about.
Yes,
it's you're not... You stopped being an advisor, effectively. Mm. You're a distributor.
Yes, I think that's actually happening.
It's Martin Hickling. Just a question on cost allocation. As I understand, under MySuper, you can only charge costs related to effectively the default MySuper area, which might make it difficult if you have cross-subsidisation between the sort of default MySuper type products and choice products. So do you think that's going to put a lot of pressure on the higher costs of the choice options?
So the question is about whether there'll be cost pressures on the higher cost. So the currently the cross-subsidisation to the lower cost default type options will have to cease, because you can't allocate costs between. So effectively the more complex choices become more expensive. I guess it depends on the level of cross-subsidisation that exists at the moment. I'm not as close to the investment side as I am to the life side, so I don't know how much of that actually happens. But you would have to think that if it does at the moment, that it would have to reduce, because there'd clearly need to be some level of independent review of the cost allocation.
So I think, yeah, as we mentioned, one of the themes is a strong focus on the efficiency, you know, with which super is delivered, and I think that's across all categories. So some of the principles that are going to probably be learned from the default categories, the idea is that those are applied further up the chain to the choice categories as well. So I think it's across the board. The review is really looking for, you know, improved efficiencies and a hard look at profit margins, as we mentioned.
While the microphone's getting around to John, I just should also give one more thanks, and that's to the Camel Club. I did take an early version of this to the Camel Club to get their views, so there were quite a few views that came out of that that were very useful. So thanks to my fellow appointed actuaries around the table who helped to contribute to this presentation. And over to John.
Thanks. Probably not a question for the panel, but maybe a couple of just general observations in terms of what I think might occur out of these changes. In terms of the making of the fiduciary duties in the Corps Act, puts, I think, a greater onus on the advisor, as you've already brought out, and given it's part of the Corps Act, that potentially means that if you don't provide decent advice, then there's, with us becoming a more litigious society like the States, a lot of potential risk of financial penalties and lawsuits down the track. So I would think that with the greater costs of making sure you've done the right thing and also the insurance that you need against those potential lawsuits down the track, that is going to mean that it's going to be very expensive for advisors to provide advice and protect their own backs as well against potential legal suits, which is going to make advice very expensive. The fact that in superannuation, you used to pay for advice through a commission that was deducted out of your super balance, meant that though it was maybe declared, you didn't actually have to pay it, you didn't really see it so much. I'm not sure how it's going to be in the future, whether you will be able to pay for those fees for the advice out of your superannuation account or whether you have to fund it outside super, but either way, I would imagine that advice is going to be costly and less palatable to consumers for superannuation. It's going to be large sums of money, and people are probably going to be less willing to pay it. On the life insurance side, if we go from the current model where the agent wants a sum of money up front for spending the time with you and understanding your needs and providing a recommendation, at the moment they get a commission, which is effectively not a fee for advice. It's more of a reward for selling the manufacturer's product. But flipping that round to fee for advice where they want that sum of money up front. In the past, the commission funding is really where you're paying the agent for the advice up front, but the insurance company is actually giving you a loan, and you're repaying that loan over time through your premiums. Now, if you pay fee for advice, you've now got to fund that upfront fee out of your pocket straight away rather than being able to spread that over the time. So that's also going to make advice less easy to pocket for the consumer. So we've got this situation, I think, where we've already got under insurance. We talked in the first plenary session about how people need advice but aren't getting it. So all over the picture is people need more advice. I think all these changes are going to mean that people are going to get less advice because they won't want to pay for it.
Well, we did certainly suggest that the cost of providing advice might go up, and I guess the question is, there's a supply-demand thing. The cost is definitely going to go up. What's going to happen to the demand in that context? So, yeah, some very good points there.
Yeah. I suppose the other aspect of that was the suggestions around the tax deductibility of advice in the future may make it somewhat cheaper, but that hasn't yet been taken up. So we'd have to see what happens there, and then I guess the other I think those are all valid points you're raising, and really to find, you know, models for delivering advice that are going to be financially viable is going to be quite a challenge for providers, you know, of advice in the future. So see what happens there.
Okay, if there's no more questions, I'd like to thank Lee and Jennifer for a very good summary of what's going on, but also a very well-considered crystal ball as to where things might go. So if you'd like to join me in thanking Lee and Jennifer for a great presentation.